correct.
And what's your last name?
A-R-T-A-N-U-Y.
Okay.
Do we have the folks from the Pacific region yet?
Yeah, Eric Lauzon.
Okay.
We need Jordan Girth. Is he on?
Jordan Girth is here with Kababa Sims.
You also have Dave Plummer from NTEP.
Good.
Was that you that came on, Dave?
Yeah, about a minute ago.
Yeah, this is Gene Petrescu from Alaska Region Headquarters.
Okay.
That's old house here, Ed.
Doug, that's a good thing.
Yeah, if we were in a conference room, we wouldn't all fit, would we?
Yeah, there's
we'll keep it structured, Doug. Don't worry.
There's a lot of interest. Well, let me just...
That's fine.
Let me just go down the list that I have right now, and if there's anybody else, let me know. I have Jason Burke, Kevin Fuel, Jordan Girth, Eric Lau, Kevin McGrath, Deb Molinar, Gene Petrescu, Matt Smith, Gary Jedlovic, then Doug and Frank, David Plummer, Phil Ardney. Phil, how do you say your last name?
A-R-D-A-N.
How do you say it? It's Phil Ardnoy.
Yep. Ardnoy, okay.
Jim
Heil. Who else haven't I called?
Bill Ward.
Oh, hi, Bill.
Hi.
Anyone else?
Bill Schoberg.
Hello, Bill. Okay, I'm going to turn it over to Ed Mandel.
Okay. The Gozar folks have been asking me different questions about AOIPS 2, and they have been starting to get involved and have been looking at the code and working with it, and they have lots of needs down the road as far as being able to support Gozar and all the new products that are being generated, and helping decide what are the right ones for the right WFOs, and working through all that. And that's a lengthy project that's going on. But kind of in preparation of that, folks have been looking at the software, various folks, and kind of general questions have kind of come up. So we thought we'd just get together at least a little introductory Tim here today. We've got 2 hours and 8 topics, so maybe we spend 15 minutes on each and just try to kind of walk through these topics that we have. If there's lots of other issues or lots of other information that needs to be transmitted, we can take some notes and we can schedule some Tims down the road to kind of address that. So I think our first shot here is just kind of get through all the topics, see what we can address or not address, and set the stage for future discussions. Is that your understanding, Doug?
Yeah, sounds good.
Okay.
Before we get started, too, Jordan has volunteered to take notes today, and really appreciate that. That way, Ed can share with other development organizations some of the information that comes out of today's meeting. Jordan, were you thinking about recording this, too? And if so, we need permission from folks.
Yes, if there's any, unless there's any objection, we'd like to take an audio recording of today's call.
So, Doug or Frank, do you have any problem with that?
Frank doesn't. I'll let Doug speak for himself.
Yeah, no, I don't have any problem with it.
Okay, great. Thanks.
I might say something stupid.
That's okay.
You have to get in line with the rest of us, Frank, though. Okay. Does Jordan kind of walk us through this? Is that?
Well, I don't know. Jordan, you wanna lead each topic off?
Sure, I can do that if that's how we want to do things.
Just so everybody knows, I'm looking at the appendix that was in the work assignment.
Yep, that's the right thing. First topic is current code overview.
Okay. I guess I'll start each discussion by kind of just summarizing what we meant in this topic item. The first thing that the GOES-R program needs to know kind of extensively is kind of an end-to-end analysis of the current code that is used for the satellite imagery ingest and as well as the display end. So an end-to-end look at how the operational products are entered into the system in the GINI format and then how they're stored in the in the database as well as the metadata base, and then displayed on the screen and properly enhanced. The reason we need to know this information is because we're going to be expanding the cooperative institutes and other GOES-R partners are going to be expanding the number of satellite imagery and products with test products from NPP as well as simulated GOES-R ABI imagery in the software and potentially roll that out to the field after the AWIPS 2 software has been deployed.
Okay. This is Frank. I can give you kind of a high-level description. And if we have some really detailed questions, we might want to write those down, and then I can have one of the developers help with that, if that is okay.
Yeah, that's good. We'll go from there.
Okay. Well, basically, in AWIPS 2, all the different data types that are ingested, all the information about that data type that's needed and everything that happens to it is sort of encapsulated in a plug-in. Now, for satellite, there's a plug-in called com.raytheon.edex.plugin.satellite, and it probably should be called GINI Satellite. It's actually fairly tailored towards the GINI format. So I would just want to preface with that comment because deal with other satellite formats, we would develop other plugins. And we do have a MacIDIS plugin that's been developed and so on. But the one that's included in the distribution is this GINI satellite plugin. Okay, so that's the first assumption. And I can describe a little bit about what that does. And so you just get a flavor of what's going on. The GINI format is a binary format, a product format for satellite data that comes over the satellite broadcast, and it's got a header and then a body, and the data can be compressed in like a zip format of some kind, and we can deal with both the uncompressed or compressed. The other thing about it is it's in a product format, so that means it's geolocated and it's been reprojected onto a standard Earth projection, and that area data is in the header for that projection. So one of the steps is there's a in that plugin there's a decoder, a class, Java class that decodes it. So a lot of the details of the GINI format are really embedded in that decoder class, and that's the thing that extracts the metadata out and the basic data record that goes with it. And a couple other things. It does create a coverage object, which is then put into a steel tools style geometry object for doing spatial queries again, and that's put in the database. And that's kind of a general thing. So that metadata that's in the header is converted into that. Okay, then the data itself, the binary data itself, depending on the resolution and the size of it, gets quad-tiled by JAI, Java Advanced Imaging Library, into an automatic number of levels. So, like, as I remember, I'm just doing this from memory, but I think the 1 kilometer GOES-R data, VIS, is it's got 5 levels quad tiling to it. Some of the smaller products aren't tiled, but that's all automatic. So if the data has a higher resolution than, say, 1 kilometer, it would automatically deal with that. And then that gets put into an HDF5 file, organized by hour. And I believe each decimation has got a separate place that it goes into the GOES-R file, or the satellite HDF5 file. And the metadata that it extracted goes into a Postgres database table along with the spatial information. And then there's a column in the database that we call a data URI that references that particular area file with the HDF5 data. So that's the IGES side of it. Is there any more any questions about that?
Deb Molinar here. When you talk about using the predefined, the standard projections, you're just talking about like Lambert conformal or polar stereographic. You're not talking about the current sectors that are used in AWIPS, like the West CONUS and East CONUS?
Right. We're talking about like basic map projections, like, yeah, like you're right, like Lambert conformal, formal or Mercator, something like that, or stereopolarographic.
Okay, great. So our data would not have to conform to anything other than the mathematical projection.
Right.
Excellent.
And we don't reproject the data. We take the data as it comes in its native projection. And I think there's another question that talks about how it gets displayed, and I can tell you what happens to it after later for making it display. But at least in, I think, if I remember right, most of the data that we get for like the midsection of the U.S. is in a Lambert or a Lambert conformal projection.
That sounds like a huge improvement.
Well, yeah, and there's a on the display side, there's a lot going on, but that in some cases doesn't really matter so much. You know, for display purposes, the data can be stitched together and so on.
Okay.
To create greater areas of coverage than a single product would get.
Okay, that answers my question. Thank you.
Any more on the NGIS side before he moves to the display?
Well, I might say a little bit more about the IGES side. I think you could probably take, if you have access to the code, and you're interested in a little more detail, you could look at that satellite plugin, because there's quite a bit of code in there that has a lot of the detail that we're talking about. One particular, I already talked about the decoder, that's that's kind of important for the GENIE format because that's specific. Another one that's interesting to look at is the metadata record that goes into the metadata table in the database. And that's all defined in one class. The satellite record .java class has annotations in it. We use annotations.
Okay.
So actually it's the class that defines the metadata, and then the annotations define the pieces that actually go into the metadata record in the database, and then in addition to that, the annotations also define what becomes a data URI, you know, how is that particular record referenced by the display side of things. And that's all pretty clear when you look at that class.
Okay, I just thought of one more question, and this might be, you know, something to answer down the line since we are kind of on a short time schedule here. In terms of other products coming in besides what's being broadcast over the SBN, it sounds like everything is going to kind of be flowing into one pipe, right?
So No, not quite.
Okay.
We have about 60 different data types that AWS 2 is designed to handle. And each of those pipes is really handled by its own plugin. So, like, we have Grid 2, we have Grid 1, we have lots of different kinds of point data.
Okay, but for satellite?
But for satellite, it's basically this one plugin. But
since our data isn't going to be coming in on the SBN, will there be a mechanism that we should use to get it to be recognized by...
Yes. Yeah, there's a... okay, I can back up a little bit so that there's a understanding of how the data flow works from the satellite. We use LDM. And LDM has a module that connects to the digital video broadcast receiver.
Okay.
And then we've modified that somewhat so that it sends basically messages to our ingest side. We call that media. Whenever a file comes in through LDM, but to facilitate testing and development, we have a manual Dropbox, so if somebody has a file or an archived piece of data, they can just manually copy it into this Dropbox, and it'll pick it up and then send it to the right plugin and ingest it.
Fantastic.
And I forget the exact name of that, but it's got the word manual in it. I think it's SBN / manual, something like that.
I can look for that.
Yeah. But now there's one additional complication, though, with that, is the routing is controlled by the WMO header.
Okay.
And there's an XML file with each plugin that has the WMO filters that are appropriate. I'm going to look at that for you. There's a file called satellite_ingest.xml that has the filters, WMO file filters, and that may need to be modified if you're just making up your own name.
Okay.
Hey, this is Matt Smith with NASA Sports. Just a quick question. Somebody mentioned Makaitis. Is there a Makaitis plugin that has been developed by Raytheon?
Yeah, there has been, but it's kind of prototype-ish, I would say, at this point, and it was developed in our research and development group for other purposes, not really for the delivery with AWS. But, I mean, with some extra work, it wouldn't take too much to turn that into something that could be included.
But it's not in the latest release?
No. The only thing that would be in their latest release would be this GENIE satellite plugin.
Right. All right.
Hi, Frank. This is Dave Plummer at NTEP. Just like to notify everyone that we have, in fact, been working on a MacIDAS data ingest and display mechanism. So we do have a MacIDAS plugin that we're going to be delivering when we finally get the NTEP stuff, you know, in line with the baseline.
Okay, so that'll be good news for you know, the people that have an in-map style installation.
Okay, any other questions?
Yeah, I just have a comment. We just need to get that out, the fact that capability would be there out further afield so that there may be other people that could use that as well.
Well, it's, I know for a fact that that capability would be needed by full CODIS sites like Hawaii that have direct readout satellite receivers.
Yeah, exactly.
And right now they have, a box that converts from MacIDAS to Genie for ingestion to AOS 1. That box could be eliminated, you know, with the MacIDAS plugin.
Okay, note taken that we need to get that information out.
Bill, you got any more on the ingest
that, right?
Yeah, I heard that, and yes, that's a correct statement. If you're looking for us to chime in.
All right, any other issues on the data ingest? We want to just kind of keep moving. Frank, would you want to talk about the display?
Okay, I'll try to talk about the display. That's where I'm a little weaker, but if you want more detail than I can give you, then we can take some action items and I can get a developer to look at it. But basically, at one level, what happens is in the AWIP menu system, for example, for satellite, they have a menu reference to the different products that are available. So, for example, if you're interested in IR, there would be a reference, you know, like a pull-down reference for that. And also what that menu item would have is the latest time that's available that's been in the metadata database. Okay, then when you click on that, it uses the data URI. Go to the HDF5 file and reference the data. But there are several activities that go on simultaneously. And I'll try my best to describe that, but I'm not guaranteed this is exactly right. But I think what happens is the base map that you want to display it on, it has the geometry of that on the display, and then that's used to basically convert the tiled data into that projection. I mean, it creates the corners of that tile on how it will go on that projection. And there's an eclipse job that does that. So I think someone could look at that and get some of the details of how that works. But there's a Crate Tile job and that does some of that. So the data itself is, from the point of view of the display, is treated like a OpenGL texture. So whatever format it's in, you know, if it's in the grayscale pixel format or whatever it happens to be in, it's just loaded in the graphics card as a texture, and then it gets warped around the vertices that were loaded previously, and that forces it into the display projection. So in a sense, what happens is the data gets reprojected within the graphics card by warping around a solid world mean, that's a little hard to see. I mean, it's easy to see when you're operating the system, but it's a little hard to see from the code that it does that. The other thing that happens is there's a shader program that gets loaded when Cave starts up that basically maps the color table to the texture value, pixel values, and comes up with the color that the thing gets displayed at. And the color tables are stored on disk as XML structures, standard XML structures. And I think there are quads, so there's like four values, RGB, and then there's an alpha for each entry. And so along with that menu item selecting the data, it also selects the color table, and then that gets loaded into the card. And I think the color table gets loaded as a one-dimensional like texture in the card, and it's that shader language then that can then take that data and map it between that texture and the data, and that happens like instantaneously. So the other aspect of this is it's just the tiles that are cover the display area are loaded. So if you zoom in and out, you get new tiles, either decimated tiles if you're zooming out, or if you zoom in, you get finer resolution tiles until you hit the limit of the data. And then if you pan, you get new tiles loaded. So there's constantly this activity going on between the display and the repository for the tiling interface.
Want to pause there for some questions?
Yeah, this is Jordan Girth, Sims. You know, we've been looking into this. It's been a bit difficult, a bit more difficult from the display side on analogs between the current AWIPS and AWIPS 2.
Oh, yeah, you're in two different universes there.
Yeah, agreed. but, you know, a lot of the configurability we did from the GOES-R side, we did a lot of different localization files on the AWIPS 1 side, and these were just flat text, pipe delimited files that we used to, for example, set value mappings, set legends, make menu items, things like that. We've been going through and looking at some of the XML structure and, you know, how the XML calls the URI and then accesses the HDF. But what's been a little bit more unclear is first, you know, exactly how the legends within the viz are set. They almost appear to be essentially hard-coded into the source as like a public static class or something like that. And then the other question was these value mappings. Exactly how does it go from the bit space to the, you know, readout value? For example, we read in the Gini format is 2 to the 8, so there's 256 or so possible values, and, you know, we map those, the IR window, to into temperature space between, for example, plus 50C to maybe minus 100C on some scale like that. And they may be logarithmic, they may be linear, it may be a piecewise function, something like that. Any idea on how that's done?
Well, vaguely. Basically, in the satellite plugin, there's a series of classes that do some of that. There's a class to convert IR temperature to pixel converter thing. So there's some of that that's very specific types of conversions. So like when you turn on sampling, you basically just are displaying temperature when you're sampling IR.
Mm-hmm.
That is, so I think if you looked at that, you'd probably see a little bit how that's done.
Yeah, we have looked in there.
Okay. And exactly how the ledges work, I'm not sure. I'd have to probably take an action to get back on how the legends get created. I'm not real sure on that.
But it looks at least looking at the at some of the convert IR to pixel, whatever these are. It looks like they're more formulaic. Like we have to actually enter formulas, mathematical formulas, which is a little more expandable, but it's very different from how we've done things previously.
Right. And then there's another aspect of this. There's that shader language, it's kind of parameterized. Like the bid-back values and a number of things that control that. And that's done when the data is selected. So that part of it's worth looking at, too, because that controls what you actually see on the screen as far as color.
And I think we actually have some more specific questions about image blending and use of the alpha channel for some things that we have in the OSIP process on the NWS side right now to increase the capabilities there. And that's one of our 8 topics. So
okay.
In order to keep our time, I think we'll postpone that for that section. Is there any other questions for display before we move on to the actual data storage architecture? Okay. The next topic here is data storage architecture. And we have a few questions about this. There may be, the question came about is whether the current file and directory structure is suitable for the current and expandable uses of satellite imagery and products. This topic came out of interaction with the warning decision training branch and how they restructured the storage of the radar data. Right now, you're using hourly bins, which is, I think, how most data was originally stored in the on the EDEX side. But since then, different data sets have gone to more, by-product storage or different storage mechanism. So one of the things we would like to assess is whether or not a file name convention based on the ingest time is useful. Whether or not the file is new or old, and if it, if it's desirable to have the data bins pretty much decoupled from the metadata base. That's been kind of one of our big questions as well.
Okay.
So. Can you spend some time talking about logistically the data storage?
Well, a little bit. Just recently, because of the training decision branch, we've changed our this is within the last few days. We've changed our HDF5 binning to be, I believe it's now, instead of ingest time, it would be like data time.
So everything will be in data time?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. And then I think also the files themselves have that hour, that data time in the file name. So that if they're taken out of the system, like if they're archived away, you kind of know what you got. Now, as far as the coupling with the metadata, I don't think there's any plans to change any of that. The concept of the data URI is basically kind of a sort of a fundamental aspect of that, of the way that works. And the main purpose of the Postgres metadata is for discovery of the data of what's currently there, for creating catalog queries. Drive things like the volume browser and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
But that's all flexible in the sense of the record classes define what becomes a data URI and what becomes a metadata item. So there's nothing hard and fast about the rules for that. It's just that there is a connection between the two, and then have to be the data URI. But it's the annotations in the record class that actually define the details of that. And there are a few things that are standard in the data URI. I think it's the plugin and basically time. And a couple things like that are standard in all the data URIs, regardless of data type. But then after that, it basically falls a progressive refinement of the data. You know, like the satellite, it goes. And you can kind of see that structure if you look through the classic data browser.
Mm-hmm.
In Cave, because that follows basically the metadata structure by just doing successive queries. So, you know, the first level, it just lists the satellite products that have come in, like GOES 11. And then it breaks it down into, like, Alaska, Hawaii, so on. And then if you go further, then it gets down into the channel, like the IR and visible and so on. But that sort of structure I just described to you, that's basically set with the annotation in the record class. So that's adaptable to however you want to set things up. And each plugin has its own structure for that.
Okay. One of the things that we've noticed is, you know, and we realize that we have some earlier editions of the software. Everything is still in beta, but you know, we occasionally have a disk fail or a plugin not work right, and it seems like we can sometimes get a disbalance between our what's in our HDF5 bins and what's in our metadata base. Because what's in the metadata base doesn't require any really too much in the terms of disk space allocation, whereas the HDF5 requires a big disk space allocation. Is there anything that's been done to more closely reconcile that so that if there is an error in trying to write to the HDF5 bin, that it's not listed to the metadata base, or there's a better way to kind of retroactively?
I don't know how old your software is, but I think somewhere along the line, I think we wrap that whole cycle in a transaction.
Okay.
So that, I think we went through a phase where there were possibilities for disconnect.
Mm-hmm.
But I think once that happened, and I'm just speaking from memory here, I believe that's pretty remote now that'll happen because of using that concept of a transaction. So between the Postgres and the HDF5, I believe, if I remember right, the sequence is that it writes to the HDF5. It tries to write to the HDF5 first. If that's successful, then it goes ahead and makes the metadata record. Now, if the metadata record fails, you got a piece of data in the HDF5, that doesn't really hurt anything. But what does kind of screw things up is if you have a metadata record without an accompanying HDF5.
Yeah.
And so I think the transaction rollback helps that situation.
And
I can find out more detail on that. I mean, whoever's taking notes could make a note on that, and I can then verify with the developer exactly how that works.
Yeah, I'll write that down. I think going forward more broadly about those kinds of things, the more we put experimental data sets, you know, everything kind of, you know, runs with the EDEX as the backbone. If one of our developers or one of our products creates, you know, big problems, you know, the last thing we want is to crash an entire operational system or produce a disconnect. So, at least from my perspective, it's very important to analyze where the fail points in the system are or where they could possibly be when we make enhancements to the software.
And then there, and I mean, a plug, it could only do something kind of bad in terms of memory management or execution time. So those kind of things have to be watched to not impact the rest of the system.
Right. And the latest versions we've gotten, and R1 G14 is going to be arriving shortly to us, but... it seems like that things are a lot better. The durability, the EDEX with just the operational feed, is a lot more steady.
Yeah, a lot of work that done on making it pretty stable. I think it's pretty good at this point. Plus, there's not that many changes going around in the plugin.
Yeah, but still, that kind of analysis is going to be pretty critical for us, especially because we are going to be working with some relatively large data sets. I mean, this satellite data and some of the, especially the new satellite data, we're looking at extremely high resolution. And so the data sets are going to be quite large. And I have noticed there are some, at least in the satellite decoder, some maximum image sizes set and some file sizes set in there.
Yeah, there's some issues. This is vaguely remembering. I think the JAI, the Advanced Imaging Library from Sun that we use, there could be issues with that if things get really huge. Although I think the next level of data is fine with it. There may be a point, though, where it can come up with that. But we're using that to decimate the data and highlight in there.
Okay. Any other questions?
Okay, next.
Okay, next topic is the data format architecture itself. You know, we'll need to understand where the dependencies in the data bin array lie between the storage, the metadata base, and the display. The mapping of colors to the data bin values for display is really central to adequately handling the bit depths. And the other thing is I think I know the answer to this, but I haven't tested it extensively. What kind of limitations are on that HDF5 bin? Can we put a 24-bit array in there, so to speak? And then, you know, eventually we have to trace that all the way back to the display. So, you know, what classes are handling going from that HDF5 bin to the display? What part of it is going from the raw ingest format through the decoder to the HDF5 bin, and then what's going from the ingest, what classes handle the ingest to the metadata base? I think you've touched on this mostly, and then through the display, so depending on the map projection, it can be rendered correctly. What kind of limitations are we looking at in terms of that,
you know,
that setup?
Probably another thing to look at is the GRIB plugin, but GRIB data is stored in 32-bit floating point in the HDF5, and that's actually what gets loaded into the card as a texture. So the card can support textures of different data types, like 16-bit. Let's say I think there's short, that would be 8, and then there's 16. I believe there's 32-bit in then there's a 32-bit floating. So there's really no inherent limitation with, you know, with 24-bit data.
But there's a lot of limitation that's kind of built in. For example, in the satellite decoder, we see that data classed as a byte.
The Gini, you know, you're talking about the Gini data.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, you would have to, right, you'd have to have a new satellite plug-in that, like the Bacitus one or something that dealt with a larger bit type or bit level. I'm not really sure how the new data would be. Is each channel like 24 bits, or is it?
I think each channel, each channel actually in GOES R is going to be approximately 12 bits if we enter it raw. If we enter it already processed, it would only be 8 bits. So it would be a simple three-way image compositing.
But, you know, the image compositing could be done inside the graphics card.
Yeah, right. That's right. And that
might be a better design, but you'd have to, that way the rawer data could be in the HDF5 in its original format, 12-bit or whatever. And then multiple textures loaded into the graphics card, and then the shader language modified. The shader languages routines are really small. Like, the one that we're using now for Gini is like, I don't know, 20 lines of code or something. It's just really, really small. So you could then come up with a real high-performance scheme where you have the multiple channels loaded into the graphics card, and then the RGB values get mapped dynamically. So you're creating a composite product that you see on the screen dynamically, and then that allows you then to have controls and manipulation.
Is that resource-wise on the workstation, is that the best way?
Yeah, by far.
Okay.
Because, I mean, what's the other approach? Is to combine that data in the main processor at the CPU, and that's pretty intensive. The shader thing is optimized for that kind of vector-level kind of processing, you know, where you're doing the same operation.
Mm-hmm.
And especially, I mean, even the graphics cards that are in laptops are pretty good. And then most workstations have higher-end ones. So I would think along those lines. You may need some help from us to design that, but I mean, we could without a whole lot of changes, I think, accommodate that kind of thing.
I mean, we already see, and again, this is one of the topics. Maybe we should just jump to this one and then come back. But image blending and use of the alpha channel. You know, the way things were in AWIPS 1, you had essentially, a two-way composite was the max. You could either blend two images or just load one image. In AWIPS 2, we see a fundamental difference in that you can keep layering, images on top of each other and then use the alpha channel to bring out the opacity between those two or however many images you have loaded within the viz.
Yeah, that's because the alpha is can be controlled for each layer independently. That's an important advantage, and we made sure that we did that because of there's people doing intensive image analysis, like in Alaska for snow and ice and cloud distinguishing.
Mm-hmm.
That have actually, they don't use AWIPS 1 for that. They use a homegrown local app for that, just for that sort of interactive image analysis. But what we put in there was just a flavor of what could be done, because there's a huge potential of how that imaging widget, I don't know if you've seen it before, but the imaging widget that has the brightness, contrast, and alpha controls in it,
mm-hmm.
and the color map selection. That's all dynamic and interacts with the card dynamically and then instantly applies to an animating loop. I think there's a lot of potential there in the kinds of controls and having a little algorithm tied into it and things.
Okay. On I guess on that topic, and it comes to these XML files, there's really no, the color file, the color tables that are in XML, there's no real limitation to the number of values that can be rendered. So, for example, if we have the 32-bit or an integer type in lieu of a bit type, you know, we can show in excess of 2 to the 8 individual colors,
right.
Which is what was our, which was our limitation in AWIPS 1.
Right, that's true.
Okay.
Right now, I think we just have 256 for most of the color tables because that basically maps into what AWIPS 1 had, but there's no inherent reason it needs to be.
So I can just expand that
XML, those XMLs.
Those XMLs to be kind of infinite.
Yeah.
In the number of colors. Oh, that's good. Interesting. Does anybody else have any questions? Okay. Then we will continue on with the metadatabase architecture. The big thing we need to know about the metadatabase architecture is exactly what components of what's stored in the metadatabase are used in the display. We've talked about mapping projections and that information because it's stored natively in the HDF5 bin when it arrives. But we see other information in there. Could you speak a little bit about the value in that additional information? And
well, I think I'm just speaking about the satellite. The satellite metadata, I think, has a lot of stuff in there that's really not used for anything. There's a lot more metadata than necessary just to display it or catalog it. But I couldn't tell you right off without having somebody help me what is actually physically used for the satellite. But for what's intended, the design concept is that what's intended to be metadata is for discovery purposes. And if you have a data URI that maps directly to the HDF5, you don't need to go to the metadata for anything to work with the data. Was the intent.
Okay. For
now, I realize that when you're getting into the complexities of your new data, you're going to have a lot more metadata than you would have here, and you may have algorithms that need that. But to me, and this might require some design level thinking. The metadata is intended to be for discovery purposes, and if you need it for calculations or other activities, it probably should be in the HDF5.
Okay.
Because you can set up schemas and structures in the HDF5, and those, and that probably makes more sense of where to put that kind of dynamic data. And we've kind of gone through this with point data. We used to put, for example, with MeCharts, we put the decoded values in the metadata database, and we had performance issues with that, so we ended up redesigning that completely so that all that was in the metadata database was enough stuff to reference the correct MeCHAR. And then the decoded values are in array structures in HDF5 itself.
So, Jordan, do you need some other information to, in order to use the metadata?
I mean, looking, I've looked through what's stored in the metadata database, and you know, we're gonna when we make these additional plugins, we're gonna be storing other data, and with that we would like to conform as much as possible to the already set inner workings of the system. For example, in AWIPS 1, we don't have our own, display side. We, use the IGC processes and all that that's already, implemented. And so, I'm just trying to make sure, it looks like we may have to work things from both ends in the EWIPS 2 software, but I'm just trying to, make sure that there's not shortcuts that we may be able to take along the way to use more of the baseline, which is essentially efficient for some of the CIs here who, do have, to some extent, limited time and resources and background, and as well as background in some of these areas. So I also know that there's people that are interested in putting that metadata actually onto the screen itself. For example, to know that I'm looking at an image from GOES 13. Right now in both AWIPS 1 and AWIPS 2, you're told it's a visible satellite image that's on the screen. But we don't tell that it's that it's from GOES 13 or GOES 11.
Yeah, I think at that level, that data is in the metadata database, and it could be as part of the legend. We were just black boxing our legends to match AWIPS 1. I think so. That level of detail could already be accommodated with what's there.
And the other thing that we have with looking forward to the NPP side or any of our polar instruments is that, we have polar imagery that comes in at set times. There's more and more of these blended products now which blend multiple polar passes. It'd be good to maintain the individual times of the polar and the geostationary birds to give the user more information. I don't know what others have done on the call as far as, really trying to bring more of that metadata, out front on the viz side of things to really inform the user. We've kind of always just said, okay, it's displayed. All you need to know is that you have a visible image on the screen. But these are kind of the, as we get more into evolving AWIPS 2 into something where user configurability and image blending and compositing is going to be very, very desirable, whether it's on the polar, geo, or both, as well as creating products, band differencing, things like this, really finding out where all that data is stored is going to be very useful to us.
Yeah, there's quite a bit of blending already going on in AWIPS 2.
For example, image subtractions, the fog product.
Yeah. Yeah, what we've let me talk about that for that kind of thing for a second. Now, what we've tried to do is create a derived product pattern that cuts across data types and includes satellite. So what that means is you can have basically combinations like that that are calculated in Python and then that are under forecaster control. And I'm trying to find one for you real quick. If you look in the derived parameter scripts, there's some of the Python scripts that we have for like I can't think of one right off the bat, but I think there's a WV divided by IR product, which is a calculated, and there's derived parameter scripts to support a lot of those. So that's kind of how we envision that those kind of things would be done.
Okay.
And they're fast enough to operate sort of in real time with the display, because they kind of use NumPy behind the scenes to do the large manipulation. But one thing that's worth noting about the image combination stuff, there's some automatic image combination things going on where it combines goes east and goes west, and there's a time matching algorithm to choose the correct time for each of the halves, and so that they all, you know, they update correctly, you know, as new data comes in and all that. So that's kind of built in to the satellite mechanism right now. But that's mostly done, I believe, in the satellite display resource that kind of controls a lot of that.
So, how would you think the ease of implementing some kind of image blending where we had, for example, two images overlaid from each other and the no data image of one region was replaced with data from the other region if it was available?
Yeah, I don't think that would be too big a challenge. No data from one. Well, you mean like it would be kind of patchy? One would fill in the
right. Yeah, let's say, for example, right now we're dealing with polar satellites that are higher resolution. Those don't fill up the whole CONUS, but we got GOES data that may be closely time matched.
Yeah. You have a strip from a polar satellite or a polar, and then you want to fill in the size of it with geostationary?
Sure, on the fly, on the graphic side.
Yeah. And that's probably within the range of what we can do. I'm just thinking you got kind of time matching issues there. You have to probably relax the time matching quite a bit.
We would only want to do it when they were close enough in time. We don't want to just take any.
Right.
You know, and there would have to be some thresholding of the time matching set. But
yeah.
I think as we progress forward with those technical interchange meetings, I want to kind of drop in these areas where they would be good test cases for everybody to understand how the software really works. And I think this is one of those cases.
Yeah, and I could get the developer to talk a little bit about like what we do now in that area, which at least with the GOES data.
Mm-hmm.
And
it's also confusing because, as you say, not only are we looking at for when we do the fog product subtracting two bands or water vapor and IR, but we're combining GOES 11, GOES East and GOES West on the same image as well. So it's essentially like we have four different, you know, image sets loaded up there.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
And I don't know if it's something on our graphics card, but sometimes when we go over those four layers of images, it kind of flips back and forth between all of them like it can't keep up. I'm not sure what's going on there, but... But is that something that you've seen when you get too many layers like that, too many subtractions, that it can... They're trying to do some of this more, you know, zooming type thing within the display that... it's not really efficient, or is it more resources?
If you're creating a combined image, then occasionally one of the frames will have a missing goes east or goes west,
mm-hmm.
and so that kind of flashes in front of you, and that's mainly because of the time matching.
Okay.
That causes that, and people have complained about that.
Okay.
But it's just a strategy of how you want it to work. Right. I mean, there's nothing inherent in the architecture that makes it work one way or the other.
Also, well, I'll save that. Any other questions on the metadata-based architecture?
Well, so where do we go from here as far as getting you more information? Frank, you said... You have a developer in a future, Tim, that could talk to what you're doing today in the overlay area?
Yeah, if somebody could write down an action item or a question, and then, you know, specifically, and then I could have a developer help me.
In fact, I think what we need to do once we get through all these topics today is all the participants then go back and think about what's the next step in your knowledge base that you need to have filled in, and we'll consolidate that.
Yeah, I have to admit, you know, there's not much in the way of documentation that helps in this area. It's kind of like, yeah, I think it comes down to digging into it. And sometimes even that, you know, you need the guy that developed it, perspective on, you know, why things are the way they are.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, good. All right, Jordan, go on.
Okay, thank you. Yeah,
great.
Thank you. I think that's good, and I'm hoping in these future Tims again, maybe we can, along with these questions, we can have some little test cases or test projects that we work on as a group. You know, just a very small project to, again, try to make sure everybody is on the same page, because, as you said, the documentation is limited. Okay, just one other quick question before I forget it is the one issue of it appears like when you have a loop and you're loading things, that the loop moves forward in time without all of the frames being loaded, and so you see some jumping. Has that been corrected yet?
Yeah, there's been progress on that. I think that's been pretty much corrected.
Okay.
In the latest build, I mean, there's still probably a little bit of that, but I'm trying it right now on my laptop, and it pretty much doesn't blank out. You know, loads the first frame and then it goes on.
Okay. Okay. Let's go on to the next agenda. Anything else we might want to talk about on image blending and use of the alpha channel? I know this has been a very popular topic within the Proving Ground. I know Sierra has had some comments about possibly implementing up to 32-bit imagery with compositing. And, you know, exactly when we do image blending, I think we've already established that's all done pretty much dynamically and through the graphics card cores.
If you're intending to have a highly interactive system, that's sort of the way it has to be done. We've had an IRAD project where we've taken and combined channels outside the graphics card and then create a composite image.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, like, dreadfully slow.
Okay.
But,
I mean, it could be done on the EDEC side, right, right when the data comes in.
Yeah, that's not really preferable, though. The kind of the architecture of the system is such that we prefer to do things dynamically, if possible. Outside of decoding the data and put it in some standard format, most everything else beyond that, it's really preferable to do it dynamically unless it's really obnoxious. But for the, I think, you know, one of the more challenging algorithms that we have that is the cloud hiked algorithm and that in the pop-up QT.
Yep.
That actually runs very well dynamically. So you're loading a set of gridded data, and at the same time you're sampling the gridded data, you're sampling the satellite data, running a complex algorithm, displaying the results as you move the mouse around. And I don't know if you've played with that, but that's a demonstration of some pretty dynamic capability. So that's a combination of the graphics card and the, you know, what goes on in the display software.
Mm-hmm. I guess another thing that comes to mind is, you know, is the actual sampling when we have layered data like that. If we layer the data three ways and have a three-way, you know, and have each of them opaque to some extent and transparent, you know, do we see three different sampling values?
Well, you can. I mean, there's a demonstration of that under what they call the standard environment data package under the volume menu.
Okay.
And that sort of loads virtual layers of data, and when you have sampling on, you see the sample values for all those layers, even though they're not displayed on the screen.
Okay.
So, yeah, you're right. I mean, the sampling is intended to drill through all the layers. So if you have even if you have, like, meat tars, even if they're all, you know, one covers up another, so on.
Okay. So we might need a little bit of work there. For example, if we did a three-way image composite and we wanted to constrain the result to maybe, for example, give text if volcanic ash or something in a certain region of the image, or for whatever reason, to composite three different bands in some kind of formula to produce a single sampling. That's something that has been done already, or needs to be done, or needs to be done work.
Oh yeah, I think there's probably examples of that being done already. Again, probably the one that samples. There's a radar sampling that includes the topo data and the radar data,
mm-hmm.
So you can get hiked above ground of the radar gate. That combines a couple different data types. And again, I think the IR sampling combines different data types.
Okay.
Yeah, so there's... Yeah, I think the mechanisms are there and flexible enough to do what you need.
Okay, thank you. Any other comments on this topic? Okay. Next up is generalization of the satellite decoder. The bulk of the Gini format is based on the Mercatus area format. Although it's confined to an 8-bit standard. We look into the future. Is it possible to develop a one-size-fits-all satellite decoder, or are we looking into multiple plugins? We touched on this at the very beginning, and maybe there's a little bit of additional insight onto, you know, generalizing decoders.
Yeah, I think it would be reasonable to rethink the satellite plug-in, you know, from first principles, and come up with a more general approach that could accommodate. Well, I'm not sure it would accommodate automatically different, completely different formats like Genie versus Makita, but at least within a category that you only needed one decoder or one plug-in for it, and that all the variety that's within that could be accommodated by configuration data or metadata.
I mean, Genie is essentially processed from area. So
right.
You can feed area into Genie, and
it's kind of like a sub.
Yeah, it's a transmission format because they do a zlib compression on it to really tighten it down. So they put
pretty simple. So it might be possible to come up with a Makita that plug-in that would do Genie by default, or you know, as part of it. We'd have to look at that. I sort of looked at the Makita spec a little bit, and it's got a lot of stuff in it.
Right. I mean, the Makita areas can handle a lot more data. I mean, we're only used
to... It's almost like it would have to be a profile spec, in a sense, to handle, you know, transmission data and not really satellite sensor, raw sensor data.
Right. Yeah.
And I think in that case we could do it.
But
it would take, you know, a little bit of a project there to refine what that be. And, you know, we've been talking, I think, with another group. I'm not sure if it's this group, but maybe it is, about a transmission format for this type of data. And maybe, you know, something like that CDF 4 might be appropriate. That has the standard naming convention, you know, NetCDF, or with the CF convention.
Transmitting what in NetCDF4 convention? Satellite data?
Yeah. Would be a possibility as an alternative. That would accommodate a single format for lots of different types of data. But that, I mean, maybe that's a little bit broader discussion. I don't know. Somewhere along the line, we're going to have to think about that, though.
Has anybody thought of the HDF EOS format as one we may want to use for...
Yeah, we've been discussing that also as a possibility. You know, that would be kind of like Makita in the sense that you would try to develop a single plugin that would accommodate the variation.
I mean,
that takes a little more design work to do that.
Right. And as we said initially, this is a lot of data. But we're just curious, you know, as we look to expand it for different satellite, you know, we hate having to... it would be nice to have a set of tools available to us that we can build on instead of, as a community, instead of having... You know, every CI write special little, almost proprietary plugins for their data sets. It just seems like if we can, you know, all work together and come up on some standard formats and work on some standardization and generalization of what we want to do, I think the intent of all the groups is very similar. We all have different satellite imagery, simulated imagery that we want to display. But it, you know, deciding on what format is, and there's also some things that need to be discussed outside of AWIPS 2, like simply, you know, bandwidth limitations that we have. You know, and that also factors into which format we use to distribute it. But You know, as long as we're going to...
Yeah, the thing about HDF, or not HDF, but NetCDF4, you know, you can accommodate advanced compression.
Yeah.
With that. And it's got a very flexible schema structure. So there's, and then with the CF metadata, you standardize the naming conventions. That's one of the people have noticed about our system is we don't have very good standardization of parameter naming. So a METAR temperature versus a grid temperature, you know, they have two different names.
Mm-hmm.
Stuff like that
yeah.
is annoys people.
Okay. And is there any way to store the raw, the for example, the Ginny has a certain amount of metadata. That's all sent over to the metadatabase. Does it make sense to also just store that right in the HDF5 bin itself?
Well, I think that's what I was trying to allude to earlier. I think that's part of the design trade-off in adapting to a new data type is what goes in metadata goes in the HDF5. And anything that's used dynamically for display, it's better off to have that in HDF5 because the access is so much faster. Because you're basically
right.
accessing it with a data URI and it points right to it.
Yep.
So if you have a structure associated with a record, you know, that has some of the metadata in it, that's really preferable if it's used, you know, to for the display. Now, the metadata, like I said earlier, is really designed for discovery, and that's it.
Okay.
And it's not intended to store and be accessed during display interactions because that would terribly slow down the system.
Yeah, right. That's not really why I asked the question. It's more of, you know, if we can, there's one whole big thing with these decoders. You know, in AWIPS 1, we don't use decoders. We just format the data and deliver a NetCDF file right to AWIPS and then notify that new data is there without running
AWIPS
a decoder on it or anything.
One had you know, using the NetCDF3 files, they embedded, when they ingested the data, they embedded everything they needed in their NetCDF3 files.
Yeah, but not all of it was used.
Right, not all of it was used, say, but they had more complex structures in the NetCDF3 files.
Mm-hmm.
So you could just plop one down on their system and it could display it directly. But that's assuming it was the ingested data was decoded into their structure.
Okay. So do you ever see that we can get to a point where we maybe deliver already formatted data? If we generalize our data format structure now to have everything stored by data type, do you ever think we're going to get to a point when we can just deliver a data bin without having to go through a decoder?
I don't see that as entirely desirable for AWIPS 2 because there's other things that need to happen. When you ingest data, you need to create notifications so all the subscriptions and all the displays can get updated.
Yeah.
That's triggered through the ingest, you know, the ingest pipeline. Other things like making the data discoverable as things change. So it's necessary to have a metadata record in the database. I think it's a more modern approach and is actually important to building an enterprise-level system to have all that.
I would agree.
I realize that some things aren't quite as convenient because of that, but
the
that's
one
kind
thing,
of a decision we made at the beginning was
yeah. One thing we're trying to figure, and we definitely appreciate the enterprise level system. At least I do, and I understand the direction where you're trying to go. But it's a matter of working with other, you know, satellite tools that may already use a data in a similar format, whether that be HDF. And if there's metadata in there and that existing tool reads that, then we could...
Well, there's another possibility, is you could deliver data, and, say for scientific purposes, not for, real-time display, and then have a tool like the training decision branch is making that could take an HDF5 file, generate metadata, and generate the notification, that the tool would do all this to adapt it to the running system. That's a possibility.
Okay. Any other comments from the others out there, if they're still out there?
Still here, but no comments. You guys are doing great.
Okay. Okay, number 7, envisioned implementation of plugins. Maybe there's probably a little bit of governance related to this too, but if we develop a plugin, what's the best way to implement it? What needs to be done? How do we minimize conflicts between other plugins and conflicts which may arise in other builds? And how can this done, most importantly, and this kind of piggybacks on a question we had earlier about interfering with operational essential components of the software and limiting recoding and subsequent releases.
I think INSEP is probably got pretty good experience with that. They've developed both display plugins and ingest level plugins pretty independently of us in Omaha.
Yeah.
And it's worked out quite well. The plugins are decoupled from each other well enough, I think, to make that possible. You don't want to lag the current release, though, by too much if you're using a lot of the infrastructure. But
let me ask... Go ahead. You have something else?
Well, I think the plug-in pattern's been refined enough to allow that to happen, where you wouldn't step on the rest of the system too much. If you follow, kind of look at the examples that are already out there, and so you have an idea of how the interfaces work.
Let me ask you about a certain data type coming in, satellite data. We have a satellite decoder. Is there only one instance of that decoder? Does all the data, if we have multiple images coming in at the same time operationally, are those fed systematically through the decoder and entered into metadata in the data bins?
Or for the most part, that's true. It doesn't have to be that way. You could have separate decoder streams within one plugin. In general, most of them have one decoder class that's orientated towards the data that they have. But if the metadata is common and you just have different ingest arrangements, different ingest types, you could probably accommodate that with multiple decoder paths. I'm trying to think of an example of that. I think we may have an example of that. Grid 1 and Grid 2 are handled somewhat separately.
Are they still handled in their own EDECs? At least I saw some architecture design and...
The runtime is separate.
Okay.
I'm just thinking of the plugin itself.
Okay.
I think they're in the same plugin. But if you have some ideas on that, we could run it by our development you know, our key developers, and they could come up with some recommendations on how to implement it.
I mean, that's going to be kind of first and foremost, you know, how we get everything to play nice. You know, the other thing is if we do generalize things, if we're feeding everything through to a generalized SAT decoder, is, you know, whether the experimental data gets in the way of, you know, experimental data ingest side.
That can be controlled somewhat because of the ingest pipeline. You can set up how many threads and how many pipelines you want for each category, and so you can, like, you can throttle it that way.
Okay. And is there, how is it determined now how many threads you have per decoder?
Well, it's not quite by decoder. There's the pipelines, I believe, are in categories.
Okay.
And then it specifies how many threads are allocated. And I believe that's done in the edX XML file, if I remember right. And it's in the wiring files.
And what are these categories?
Hold on a second. Let me see if I can find that. Then I can tell you exactly. Well, for example, we've got... I believe there's a pipeline for like text data that's separate, and then I think we've isolated out gridded data, and then there's a generic pipeline that a lot of data uses, the majority of it.
Okay.
So I think we got three or four pipelines, and then the pipelines have a configured number of threads that kind of keep everything in balance. And that's all configurable. You know, we can add pipelines. We could add a pipeline for new satellite data and then keep the thread count low so it doesn't impact the data that's needed by operations, for example.
Has the number of threads been really fine-tuned for the operability of the system? I mean, how is that done? I mean, it would seem to me the more threads, more memory. Is that fair?
Well, no, it's a balance between memory and execution, CPU.
Okay.
So we're all the time... Okay, we're completely flexible in the sense of... we try to balance the CPU and the memory that we're using on the system by, we can balance the memory to a certain extent by splitting things up into JVM. So right now we have three JVMs, and we have a file that configures which plugins go in which JVM.
Okay.
So like we have the grid, that's why we have the gridded separate, and we have the retrieval stuff separate, and then we have everything else in another one. So there's like three, I think, now. And then each of those can have a custom amount of memory specified for them. And then likewise, the thread pooling can be specified. So we're running on a cluster, so we're trying to optimize using that hardware. You basically... What we're trying to do is if you hit the system with a huge spike of data, we don't want to completely spike out the CPUs because we want to leave a little for retrieval.
Mm-hmm.
But we want to make pretty much as much use of those CPUs as we can by doing that without going into swap.
Yeah.
So we're constantly adjusting that stuff as we do the development. And we have one guy that almost spends all his time looking at that and tuning it and stuff.
And operating system wise, I guess does play a little bit of a role. Are you still running on a 32-bit Pay?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, it would really help to go to 64-bit. That'd make a huge difference.
What's holding you back there?
Being backward compatible with AWS was initially.
Okay.
It's a big problem. The workstations will go first.
The workstations will go to 64-bit first?
Yeah. So that's a little easier. And then the servers will go somewhat later.
Do you have a general time frame for the 64-bit transition, or is it just on hold until it's going?
Well, that's probably from National Weather Service programmatic. Ed may know if he's still around.
I'm a little out of loop on the exact schedule, but I thought it was towards the end of the year for the workstation. Oh, okay. Yeah, that's correct, Frank, for the workstation, and we haven't thought, yeah, but we have a nail down on exact time yet. I think a lot of it depends on how smoothly the AWIPS2 transition goes, and once we can get rid of AWIPS1, then you have a little more freedom.
Is there a 64-bit beta of AWIPS2 available?
Well, in our research and development, people they work entirely in 64-bit.
Okay.
So it's not a big deal to us.
Because I thought I tried to install it in 64-bit, and I did have some issue as a test, but that was a while ago, and I'm not sure if I spent a whole lot of time trying to get it to work either. But should it work on 64-bit or not really?
Well, it probably should be rebuilt.
Okay.
The library theme probably should be rebuilt. The main problem is there's a lot of libraries, like for Python and like the HDF5 library.
Yeah.
That are
32-bit.
Against.
Yeah.
32-bit.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I think the JVM is not a big deal, but once you jump out of Java and into these...
Well, I mean, most of those libraries are out there, 64-bit. I mean, you could run a yum and try to upgrade them all, but...
That's true.
But
some of them we've modified a little bit, so...
Yeah.
And have to be built specifically, but...
One may need to be one thing we... work a little closer is trying to get, you know, especially if you've been modifying the libraries, trying to get a copy that runs in 64-bit, because if we're going to go that way, there's no reason we should be developing in 32-bit by deployment time.
That's a good idea, Jordan.
So. Okay. Yeah, we are going to need to talk more about the envisioned implementation of plugins. And again, I think that's going to dovetail with some of the work of governance. Which, Ed, do we have a governance timeline in place yet?
I'm working on it. No, the answer is no.
Okay. Appreciate the honesty. Okay, last topic, and then we can wrap up, is GRIB 2. Expandability and flexibility of GRIB 2 implementation. You know, GRIB 2 is kind of, I don't know if you want to call it an up-and-coming format, but it's a format that's becoming more widespread in use. Kava here recently did some work with formatting our data, some satellite products to work in GRIB 2. This is something, GRIB 2 is really something I'm least familiar about in terms of how it works, and I haven't had a whole lot of time to play with it.
Yeah, we get a lot of our gridded data in GRIB 2 format, and we're using Unidata's GRIB 2 decoder, which is a C-level thing, and that then has an interface to our GRIB plugin. So it's kind of hidden that we're using that. But
And then there's some configuration that goes with it. And I think the Unidata, it's basically the INCEP GRIP2 decoder, what it is. And I think it has built in all the support for the product that INCEP puts out.
But is it's not supported against the WMO standard?
I don't know. I couldn't answer that. That might be a question for INCEP.
Okay.
Dave Plummer still on the line?
Yes, and the answer is yes.
It is. One of the big...
If you wanted to develop to use it for satellite data, then you'd probably have to work with INCEP to make sure that any changes to the decoder get dealt with. And then we would automatically, in a sense, pick it up in ALIPS too, if we're along with that, we're using that updated decoder.
Okay.
I mean, it's a possibility to do that, I suppose. There has been some issues, though, with the large gridded data in the compression, what do they call that, the JPEG 2000 compression.
Yeah.
There's some size limitations with that. If
GRIB has different compression formats which you can use. I mean, you can do a...
You don't have to use that, the compression format, that's true.
But we're compatible across the board with AWIPS 2 if we were to do a PNG compression?
I think as long as it's supported by that decoder, we'd be fine.
Okay. The other issue is you know, there's a lot of stuff that's stored in the meta database for GRIB2, and a lot of that stuff is, for example, model identifiers. And you know, how do we? Is there a way for local products? Because I'm sure this is a question that comes up from the Weather Service side as well with a lot of their local efforts. Is there a way to deal with numerous types of local models coming in?
Yeah, there is. Because a lot of sites run their local, like a local WRF model.
Right.
Or we have to adapt to that.
How do you do that?
I don't know the specifics of that. You could write that question down and we could get back on that. I don't think it's too hard, though. And I think it's done at the configuration level.
Okay. Localization process was central to AWIPS 1. AWIPS 2, it appears the localization is done every time the cave is loaded, and there's really no localization on the EDEX side. Is that accurate?
Well, not entirely. The way the localization works is there's a data store on EDEX that contains the localized data for a site. And in some cases, mainly for GFE, and I don't know if you're concerned about GFE, but for GFE and I think FFMP, which is the flash flood monitoring program, require special processing when they localize. So there is an identifier where EDEX gets started up as a particular site for those cases.
There is a document, excuse me, Frank. There is a document. Kevin Johnson's been working on this. We've got a task order to develop this SCAT workstation and do localization and automate as much as we can for a site data migration. So I suggest that things have been changing and evolving over the last couple of months. So I think the current localization document, though, he's merged what he used to call the companion document, and probably get some insight into that now because it's progressed quite a bit over the last 6 months. So put that down in the question, and we can get that documentation to you. But the reason that you had to do localization on K every time was because of the state of the system at that time. That's not going to be the case in the future.
Yeah, now basically what happens when CAVE, you put in your localization in CAVE, and then it pulls over from that using a service, it pulls over all the data it needs to configure itself for that site, like the maps and the menus and color tables. And they're just like tons of little pieces of data that are needed, but all that stuff is dynamic. So the idea was is that you could have one site connect to, like Omaha connect to Des Moines, and carry some workload, and everything local would look like Des Moines then, without having to move any data around. It would be sort of automatic.
Mm-hmm.
I think we've been successful on that point, but on the server side, it's a little harder because of GFE and SSNP and all that kind of thing. The server side usually has to be one localization.
And everything is done in XML?
Not 100%. Most of it is, but some of it is not. Some of the localized files are preserved from AWS One.
Are we talking about basically localization for display and cave and that kind of thing?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, that's simple.
Yeah, for hydrology, they have, if you're interested in hydrology, they have their own value pair type file, and then we preserve that format for that. So, but for the basic D2D stuff, it's primarily XML, to the best of my knowledge.
Okay. Any other questions on this topic? Okay, that ends my question.
At least for today, right?
Yeah.
Are there any other questions out there right now? I know it's getting late. So I think what we should do is, well, we have some action items. I don't know if, Jordan, do you have them in any form? You could just review them, or maybe the thing to do is just write them down and send them to the group. And in fact, everyone that participated, if you have any other questions, what we'll do now is gather the topics that we want to be discussed at the next TIM, and based on what came out of this one, and some of those will be answers to whatever action items we have. If there's some documentation, like we were just talking about this localization, current localization documentation, if that's available, maybe that's something we get out before the next TIM. But let's, Jordan's going to write up some minutes or whatever you want to call them from this session. And we'll gather the action items and start developing the topics for the next 10. So if anyone can input and just send it, you know, to the reply to all to the meeting announcement with any input you have for that. Go ahead, Jordan. You have some?
Yeah, I think what would be good in addition to that is. You know, if there's certain parts of code, certain things that you're uncertain about, certain projects, certain goals you want to accomplish, working with AWIPS 2, it'd be nice to compile a list of those, because I would envision our subsequent TIMs would be a deeper investigation into some of the coding questions. Today was a very informative higher level thing, which told us a little, which told us about the architecture and directions in which we should proceed. But I know, in addition to this cursory information, that we do have, you know, especially down there at Sport, we have some work that's already ongoing to incorporate things into the software as well as here at Sims. And there, you know, we do have some knowledge and experience with the at least some of the later releases of the software. And if we could kind of come to some of those specific problems, frustrations, in addition to those questions, I think it would be good to incorporate those and then bring a few more of these developers together. For example, we talked about some of the steps we need to take for image compositing, color tables, filling, things like that, and doing mini projects. I don't know how we envision the format of subsequent TIMs going, if they will be in person, or we're going to try to do a go-to meeting and sit through it all day. I'm not sure, but I think at least from our perspective at the CI level, I think that would be a good way to go forward. I don't know how others feel about that.
How about you, Doug? How do you feel about that? Okay?
Yeah, it's fine. And, you know, I thought where he was going for a moment was that if you were trying to accomplish certain things, then the approach to take might be a discussion. Maybe it's lower level than what we're talking about today, but still it's kind of design-oriented discussion. But, yeah, we're good with all that.
Yeah,
it seems to me we're almost at a point where we might want a face-to-face with a couple of our developers in attendance that could go a lot deeper than I can.
The question would be, can they come to Omaha for that?
Well, that would be the most efficient thing for us. I don't know. As far as funding and all that, you have to think about that. But you know, we have lots of TIMs here in Omaha with National Weather Service developers. In that way, we can, depending on how the questions go, you know, we have the whole team here that we can draw on.
I'm sure they could find their way out to Omaha.
Speaking from the Sims side, we have allocated a sufficient amount of funds for multiple trips to Omaha, so that wouldn't be a problem for us.
Yeah, Omaha's a lot cheaper than Washington.
That's for sure.
And right now it's probably the best way to go for everybody because we've got this other project we're working on that folks, you know, the less we can infringe on that, the more likely we are to have to attend.
Okay.
Okay, well, let's get the input in. We'll consolidate it and then figure out when the next TIM should be, and hopefully within 4 to 6 weeks, right, Ed?
I threw that out there. I mean, I don't see how long it takes to pull that together and see what the different areas are and when we can make it happen. And done. And Frank had to balance this against everything else they're trying to do, too. So I'm sure we could fit in something.
Any other comments? Doug and Frank, thank you very much. This, I think, has been very useful. The folks you have on the line have been just chomping at the bit to talk to you guys for almost the last year now. So this has been outstanding.
It has. It's most helpful just in terms of our planning. Thank you for your time.
Well, it's like it must be overdue then. It's been a year. It's like we can have a discussion. But anyway, you guys are quite welcome. We're excited for people to be bringing capability on. That's what we wanted when we first started this.
Yeah. And yeah. I'll say just broadly, maybe to close up the call, and that, you know, we are looking. I don't know if there's other projects that are this way, but you know, we're looking long term here with AWIPS. Certainly NPP and GOES-R are a bit off in the distance, at least 5+ years out. So AWIPS 2 is a big piece in the puzzle as to how we plan, how we do data delivery, how we do data interrogation at the operations level. So we eventually, I think speaking broadly, is hoping to create a system which really allows forecasters a lot more flexibility to combine images, to interrogate the data, and provide decision support at a very different level than the current kind of black box conversion that we're working on going from AWIPS 1 to AWIPS 2. I think the image compositing is a big step forward, and it'll help to accelerate the development in that fashion. So I hope this becomes a longer discussion both within the proving ground and with the developers at Raytheon.
Yeah, absolutely. We have to figure out how to evolve this now into something that's more flexible, easy to use, and fits the future needs.
Yeah, and it would be great to kind of reconcile all these different Mechitus plugins, because from what I heard now, there's three different versions. And this is the kind of stuff that, again, it comes to streamlining. So I appreciate the time, and that's it for me.
Thanks, guys.
Hey, thanks, Frank. Thanks, Doug.
Okay, you're welcome.
Have a good one.
Take care.